Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, the California Endowment. Health happens when California values schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And the California Healthcare Foundation, rating hospitals, doctors, and long-term care. Smarter choices start at calqualitycare.org.
From Valley Public Radio in Fresno and Bakersfield, this is Valley Edition, FM89's weekly news magazine program. I'm Joe Moore. On today's show, last week's election was a big win for Republicans nationwide, but here in the Valley, one congressional race is still too close to call. We'll talk to Fresno State political science professor Jeff Cummins and get the latest vote count in the race between Jim Costa and Johnny Teixeira. We'll find out why political observers on both the left and the right didn't see this one coming. We'll also talk to a man famous for entrepreneurship, activism, and ice cream. Jerry Greenfield, co-founder of Ben & Jerry's, speaks in Fresno this week. He'll join us later on our program. And we'll hear an in-studio performance from one of Bakersfield's finest jazz musicians, Jay Smith. He has a new CD coming out this week. We'll get a sneak preview and some insights into his music. But first, on this Veterans Day, our series of stories on the lives of Valley veterans returning home from active service continues now with a bit of an unconventional veteran story. For many who have served, returning home isn't always an easy transition. A strong support system is usually necessary. As part of our series Common Threads, Veterans Still Fighting the War, FM89's Ezra David Romero brings us a love story involving one veteran and how that love brought him to the Valley and to a new career in the courtroom.
Jason Trupkin and Serena Huntington have a loving marriage, but they like to fight. Not each other, but zombies. They daily play video games together for stress relief.
Fighting the zombosses.
Today, the couple is playing a game where plants defend the Earth in the zombie apocalypse.
Why do you guys think you connect over video games so well?
Maybe it's just because we're on the same team and we're not against each other, because I think we're both really competitive. So yeah. It helps if we channel that competition to where we can help each other rather than be against each other.
The couple met online while Trupkin was in the Coast Guard station in San Francisco.
I only had Coast Guard friends, so I was like, you know what, I'm going to do Match and see if I can make some friends that are not in the Coast Guard.
There was only one problem. Huntington was eventually going to begin medical residency at the University of California, San Francisco's Fresno campus. The two dated, moved in together, exchanged vows in 2011, and then Huntington relocated to Fresno.
When we first started, we weren't in it to find love. I met him and spent the rest of my life with him, hopefully.
Hopefully.
Trupkin's wife also has a competitive side. After med school, she was offered a well-paid, highly desired job at a Fresno area hospital. With the job offer, Trupkin decided he'd move to Fresno, ending his 10-year stint in the Coast Guard for his wife's new job. Huntington was relieved.
I didn't care what he did. He was home, and that's all that really mattered. You know, I'm just glad that he's here.
The 31-year-old, originally from Long Island, New York, enlisted in the military after a semester of community college in his late teens.
9/11 happened, and I was in a professional pilot program at SUNY Farmingdale. And then we stopped flying, and, you know, I was like, you know what? I don't want to wait for this, and I just got out and joined the military after that.
In the Coast Guard, Trupkin realized he thrived in a structured atmosphere. He went through basic training in New Jersey and served as a helicopter flight mechanic in Connecticut, Puerto Rico, San Francisco, and Sacramento.
The military just demands such a high standard of you. And then when you get out, expect that standard from everyone else. You see it immediately when you get out because you are used to being around people that are held to a standard and held accountable for things.
Some of his fondest military memories come from serving in the Caribbean. He remembers an incident when a boat hauling 40 people capsized on a voyage from the Dominican Republic to Puerto Rico.
As we're turning around to go home, our cabin door slides open, and as I'm looking out, I can see four people holding onto a cooler. So I just tell the pilot to mark that exact spot where they are so we can come back and get a better angle.
It's this living on the edge mentality that Trupkin thrives on. That's why, when he moved to Fresno, he realized he couldn't sit around while his wife worked. He decided he'd go back to college with the idea of becoming a lawyer.
Before I joined the military, I didn't have the confidence I have now. I went to Fresno City College, and the light started shining more and more on law school, and I figured, you know, maybe this is something I can do.
Trupkin says his parents knew he'd perform well as a lawyer.
I do remember trying to bargain with them, avoid going to my room or, you know, getting another scoop of ice cream for dessert or something like that. They are the ones that first said, you know, you should go to law school.
Today, he's in his first semester at Samuel King College of Law in Clovis.
Can you explain why there's an exception for punitive damages and wrongful deaths in the code pleading?
When you sue for a humongous dollar amount like that.
And just like his parents predicted, Trupkin is on a 4-year journey to becoming a lawyer, and even though he says his decade in the Coast Guard will strengthen his career in law, he says he thinks about his time in the military often.
I definitely miss the missions. I miss the camaraderie, just flying in general. But I definitely think I've made the right decisions in joining and then in getting out and then going to school and coming to law school.
He's not sure what type of law he'll end up in, but so far he's fascinated by criminal and aviation law. With Valley Public Radio News, I'm Ezra David Romero.
And everyone else is carrying on just like they've always done before. You've been home for a couple of years now, buddy, but you're still fighting the war.
You can find more veteran stories on our website at kvpr.org in our series Common Threads, Veterans Still Fighting the War. Our coverage of veterans' issues is made possible in part through the support of Cal Humanities and their War Comes Home initiative. You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Joe Moore. 1 week after the election, most of the Valley's big races have been decided. In fact, decided long ago. One of those races, though, still remains, or actually a few races are still close. One of the big contests involving the 16th Congressional District still remains to be determined. And here to tell us more about that race and some of the larger trends that we saw in last Tuesday's election is Fresno State political science professor Jeff Cummins. Jeff, welcome back.
Thank you, Joe.
Jeff was here with us on election night as we were watching the returns come in. And the late last Tuesday, we started to see something interesting in the 16th District, and that's long-term Valley Congressman Jim Costa trailing challenger Johnny Teixeira, who had run kind of a very low-profile campaign. This is a race that was not on any of the big watch lists out there, either the ones that are run by Democrats or Republicans or independent media organizations. They all sort of handicap which races are the close ones. Nobody saw this. Why did nobody see this?
Well, I would probably start with the fact that turnout was much lower than what anybody thought, and the turnout that the voters that did turn out overwhelmingly favored Republicans. So I would start with that. And Costa's had some close races in the past, so he's not new to this situation. I would say the other thing going on in this race in particular is that it's a fairly new district for Costa. Redistricted in 2012, or I should say 2011, and he first ran in that district in 2012. He did pretty well. He won by 14 percentage points, but at the same time, when you're running in a new district, voters are not going to be as familiar with you. So in an election like this with a lot fewer voters turning out, they're not going to be as familiar with you. It's tilting towards the Republicans, and so we get this surprise result.
Very interesting. Now, speaking of the result that we have right now, where do we stand in the vote count? I understand that Teixeira still has a lead of about 740 votes or so, but there's still more ballots to be counted.
Yeah, true. And so we're waiting. Wednesday, we're supposed to get an update from the Fresno County Registrar. I believe most of the votes in Madera and Merced, which are the two other counties that are in this district, are pretty much about finished. So we're really waiting on those Fresno County results, and those are results that are going to favor Costa. Is the biggest Democratic votes or highest number of Democratic votes coming from that county. So it's really going to make a difference.
Yeah, Costa did relatively well in Fresno County on election night, did very poorly in Madera and Merced counties. We understand there's around 20,000 votes, actually a little over 20,000 votes that are still to be counted, about half of those absentee, half of those provisional. But do we have any idea? We don't know how many are in that district.
Yeah, hard to know how many are coming from that district. The registrar probably doesn't know until their staff starts looking at the individual ballots, yeah.
What does this mean for the Valley, a potential change in that spot? Everyone was looking at 21 in the South Valley, the Valadao Renteria race is the one that might go from, in this case, Republican to Democrat. In this case, in 16, we might see a change the other way. It would give the Valley a new Republican congressman. What would that mean? Jim Costa has been one of the biggest backers of high-speed rail, and does that mean anything there? Republicans already controlled the House, though.
Yeah, I mean, I would say it comes down to who controls the chamber that this candidate is going into, and if it ends up being Teixeira, he's a Republican, and you know, perhaps might even be more beneficial to the Valley because he would have more influence on a Republican-controlled chamber. At the same time, you're losing possibly, you know, so we don't know what the results are.
Yeah.
We could possibly be looking at losing a longtime legislator with lots of experience, has worked on a lot of different issues. You mentioned high-speed rail, but also water. He's got a lot of expertise on water that we would potentially be losing there as well.
Let's talk about water. What does the change in control of the Senate potentially mean for the Valley's water situation? Senate Democrats had their own bill. Dianne Feinstein had put together a bill that would ease some water restrictions in the Delta and free up some water in certain parts of the state. That didn't go anywhere, or at least didn't get out of the Senate. The House Republicans had their own bill that would effectively exempt the water transfers in California in the Delta from the Endangered Species Act. Likewise, that didn't get out of the House. Both of those, really the Endangered Species Act being the real contentious issue there. What do you see happening on that issue with Republicans now in control of both chambers?
I would say that it doesn't favor getting much done for California on water. When the Democrats control the Senate, you have the long-serving California senators in Boxer and Feinstein who would have more influence. Obviously, their influence is going to diminish when the Republicans take over. And Republicans, when you get control of the chamber, you have control of the agenda, so you can squelch bills by the opposing party. That's a common tactic. So I would say that the prospects for Congress passing a bill would go down. Now, of course, we do have Republicans controlling the House, and so it will depend on how much McCarthy, as majority leader, tries to push it in the House, but then tries to maybe call in some favors in the Senate to try and get a bill through the Senate as well. But I would say probably prospects are low.
Of course, Democrats still have the possibility of a filibuster on any of those bills that they find objectionable
sure,
that come
yeah.
to their chamber as well. If you just joined us today on Valley Edition, Jeff Cubbins is our guest. He's a Fresno State political science professor. We're talking about the aftermath of last week's election. You mentioned Kevin McCarthy. What does the big Republican win do to bolster his political fortunes and his agenda in the House?
Well, I mean, I don't know that it changes it that much because Republicans already had control. He was already in that position. If anything, it makes his job a lot harder because expectations are going to be higher. They have a larger margin in the House. But at the same time, let's not forget that you have a very fractured Republican Party in that chamber. You have, I forget the last count, probably around 70 Tea Party-affiliated Republicans who don't go along with what the House leadership wants to do. And he's going to have to try and bring those factions together. Right after the election, there was this a lot of emphasis placed on the fact that Republicans have to show that they can govern and pass bills and work with the president. But at the same time, if they want to get things done, there's that Tea Party faction, conservatives who don't necessarily view it the same way. They don't want to just go along to go along. They want to. They still want to repeal Obamacare and do some of these other things that they've been trying to do but have been unsuccessful.
Does the change in power in the Senate in any way affect to what we're going to see with immigration reform? The president has talked about taking his own action if Congress does not do something through executive authority. Could we potentially see something in the lame duck Congress, or is immigration reform just going to be one of those footballs that keeps getting kicked around?
Yeah, I think it'll just be kicked down the field. Yeah. I don't think it changes much in the Senate, because the Senate has always been, I would say, more open to immigration reform than the House. It's really the House that is the sticking point. And I just mentioned those Tea Party-affiliated Republicans. They're the ones that are opposed to immigration reform. So really the resistance is coming from the House. So I don't think the Senate change in control matters much.
Looking at back at the election results and some of the Valley's issues and Valley races, the other race that we were paying very, very close attention to was the 21st Congressional District, David Valadao, Amanda Renteria. Renteria, a lot of money, a much more formidable Democratic candidate than John Hernandez was 2 years earlier, who ran against Valadao. Once again, though, Valadao pulls off a pretty sizable win. What does that say about his him as a candidate, as an incumbent, and that seat, that district, which has on paper, if you look at it, well, you would say a Latino Democrat is probably going to win this seat, but it doesn't always work out that way.
Yeah, I mean, I think it says that he's a very strong candidate. He's got deep roots there, former state legislator from the area, so he's got a lot of name recognition down there. You know, I hesitate to say that it's now his seat to lose given the results of the last two elections. I think what happens in 2016, that will really tell us whether or not he's going to have that seat for the foreseeable future, because the composition of the electorate is going to be much different. You're going to have much higher Democratic turnover. So I would say that if he keeps that seat, then it's probably going to be a safe seat for a long time to come.
We've got just a few minutes left as we look back on last week's election. What are some of the takeaways that you have? What should we look at locally and then maybe beyond that for what happened last week?
Well, I mean, I think the big question, if we're, you know, limited to California, I think it raised an interesting question about why did Democrats take all of the statewide offices, yet at the local legislative races, Republicans did well? You know, so what is going on there that explains that question? And, you know, what I've been thinking about is that it just gets back to turnout and what we refer to as ballot roll-off. And at the statewide level, you know, we voter registration, the split between voter registration of Democrats and Republicans is 14%. I would say in this election, it's probably closer to 6%, where Democrats had about a 6-point advantage. That's based on the results that we got in these statewide offices. And referring back to the ballot roll-off, you tend to get higher turnout. People are voting for those higher level races. And so Democrats were voting for those higher level races. As we go down the ballot and we get into these down ticket races for state legislative seats, even the congressional seats, that fewer and fewer people are voting, and that roll off favored Republicans. So more and more Democrats were rolling off and not voting, leaving it blank.
And also on those statewide races, I understand Republicans didn't make a lot of independent expenditures on both specifically the Pete Peterson and Ashley Swearengin campaigns. I know Ashley Swearengin's campaign manager says with another $1 million, he thinks that they could have won. I've heard people say, well, yeah, right.
It would have been closer. I mean, it's a name recognition issue, and that money help get your name out. But it's true. The Republican Party, their strategy was to try and boost their chances in these legislative races. I question that strategy.
They wanted to remove the two-thirds supermajority.
That was their target. And what we end up getting is Democrats are still one vote away from a supermajority. You know, in the end, they were pretty much had that in the last session. Given the vacancies. So it was pretty much a status quo election for them in the end, I would say.
Well, it's very interesting. We'll be following the race as the next set of votes come in on Wednesday afternoon from Fresno County in the 16th Congressional District. Jeff Cummins, Fresno State political science professor, thanks again for joining us
today. All right, thank you, Joe.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Joe Moore. Our next guest has been called an entrepreneur, an activist, and an ice cream pioneer. The co-founder of the famed Ben & Jerry's chain, he speaks in Fresno tomorrow morning as part of the San Joaquin Valley Town Hall Lecture Series.
Jerry Greenfield joins us on Valley Edition. Jerry, welcome.
It is my pleasure.
You've been called a businessman, philanthropist, activist, and entrepreneur. Are those different categories in your mind, or are they all one thing to you?
You know, I guess I haven't really thought of myself in those ways. The business part and activist have actually gone well together, and it's something that I think Ben and I might not have been expecting. We started with a little homemade ice cream parlor thinking we were going to be doing kind of a small venture, and as it turned out to be larger, we also became much more active in the community activities.
I want to ask you how you realized it was starting to become larger, but before that, let's take a step back. How did you and Ben first meet?
We met in seventh grade. We were 13 years old, and we met in gym class because we were the two slowest, fattest kids in the class. And it turns out that you make really good friends with the other slow, fat kids.
What was your best sport in gym class, you and Ben?
You know, we weren't very good at all. I mean, the greatest thing about Ben was we used to play this game called bombardment, which is like dodgeball, where you try to throw balls at other kids and hurt them. And Ben refused to play because it was just so militaristic. And I never had ever seen anybody refuse to play a game that you were assigned in gym class.
Kind of an interesting insight into how our character and personalities developed very early there.
Yes.
Turning to the company and when it became that small shop that you said you started to realize was going to be something bigger, when did you realize it? Was there a moment when all of a sudden this became something beyond just this initial idea and project?
Well, so we started in 1978 as this little ice cream shop in an old gas station, and about maybe 6 or 7 years later, we had started selling ice cream to grocery stores in pint containers, and we built our first real ice cream factory. And when Ben and I saw all the ice cream that was coming out of this high-volume, mechanized, modern ice cream making equipment, I think that's when it struck us that there were a lot of people eating Ben & Jerry's ice cream.
What didn't you know when you started out?
There was so much we didn't know. It is hard to put names on it. But among all the things, one was that companies, very big successful companies, make tons of mistakes all the time. We had always thought that successful businesses were really smart and they did things great. And it turns out that not all businesses that are successful are really smart. They're no smarter than these small local businesses that are doing things. But the hugest learning for us was the role that business plays in our society and in our country. And just what a powerful force business is and how it has so much influence on everything from elections and legislation and owning and what's printed in the media. We were just never aware of that.
Did you in some way get involved in the business and growing the business in order to fuel that passion to be actively involved in society and these issues, or was it the other way around?
There was a point when we started to see the role of business. And it's not that we wanted to get bigger, but it's that we did want to choose to consciously use the business to try to help address social and environmental problems and not act just as a conventional business, which, I mean, business typically tries to make money and not really be concerned about other social issues. And we just felt like business was more like a neighbor in the community and has a responsibility to help address those issues as well.
And you made that, in modern terms, a part of your brand, part of your identity as not only individuals but as a company. That's something that in traditional corporate America, maybe corporations are involved, but they try to do things behind the scenes. They contribute money to campaigns and issues, and it's not necessarily part of their brand ethos. Did you look at it that way? There were all sorts of things happening back then, the Whole Earth Catalog and all sorts of different ideas about the role that business can play and how people can be active in social justice issues and things like that. How did you see that back then?
Well, so about 10 years into the business, 1988 or so, we wrote a mission statement that was a three-part mission to not just have an economic mission and a product mission, but to have a social mission to use the business to find innovative ways to address social and environmental problems. And so at that point, we formalized what we were really going to be about. And for us, the business is not successful unless we're succeeding at all three parts of those missions, the economic mission, the product mission, and the social mission. And so what we try to do is to integrate social and environmental concerns into the normal day-to-day business activities. And so that's been the work of Ben and Jerry's, trying to figure out how to do that. And what's been really interesting is that the more caring and the more community-involved Ben and Jerry's has been, the more successful it's become.
If you just joined us on Valley Edition today, we're talking with Jerry Greenfield, co-founder of Ben & Jerry's. He's speaking at Fresno's William Saroyan Theater on Wednesday morning at 10:30 as part of the San Joaquin Valley Town Hall, a talk titled Ice Cream, Social Responsibility, and an Innovative Business Philosophy. I want to fast forward to the year 2000, and that's when your company was purchased by a major European conglomerate. How difficult of a decision was that? Walk us through that process and what you did to try to do that differently as well.
Well, that was actually very difficult because we had wanted to stay independent. Ben & Jerry's got bought by Unilever, and it was nothing about Unilever for us. It was that we wanted to pursue our own mission, and we were concerned that any company that acquired Ben & Jerry's might not be interested in maintaining that social mission. But at the time, Ben & Jerry's was a public company, which meant anyone could purchase shares. So our board of directors was not able to find an alternative to the offer that Unilever made. So We crafted what hopefully would preserve the values of Ben & Jerry's, and it includes having the majority of manufacturing stay in Vermont, to continue to use milk and cream from family farmers in Vermont. The company continues to fund the Ben & Jerry's Foundation as the charitable arm. And so there were some provisions that we wrote into the acquisition agreement that I think has been really helpful.
You mentioned a moment ago about when you started out, you didn't realize that successful companies sometimes also made mistakes. What were maybe some of the ones that your company made, or is there anything that you would have done differently looking back, not just on the deal there, but uh-huh. overall in business, maybe when you were starting out or things, that lessons that you learned?
Well, first of all, Ben & Jerry's has always and continues to make enormous numbers of mistakes, and it's actually not a bad thing. Making mistakes, trying new things, and learning from those is how we move forward. It's the process of innovation. Doing something new, you don't know how to do it, and it involves trial and error. And so that's actually a positive thing. One of the most interesting things in terms of a company like Ben & Jerry's is coming out with new flavors, because most new flavors don't really work, even when Ben & Jerry's tries to come out with new flavors. In any given year, the company will come out with maybe 4 or 6 new flavors. And to come up with those 4 or 6 new flavors, we start out with about 200 ideas, and in the end, whittle that down to those small number. And even when you come out with those small number of flavors, half of those don't work as well.
Were there any particular flavors you were maybe favorites of yours that you thought were going to be a big success but didn't turn out to have that success in the market?
Well, my personal favorite flavor of all time, coconut almond fudge chip, is no longer with us. It is in the flavor graveyard of Ben & Jerry's. It is one of those wonderful and dear flavors that has left us, that is no longer reaching people's mouths. Ben's all-time favorite flavor, mocha walnut, is also in the flavor graveyard. So it turns out that even Ben's and my favorite flavors don't stick around if not enough people buy them.
Your company continues to be at the forefront of a lot of social and progressive issues. One of them involves GMOs. Your company recently made a pledge to remove all GMOs from your products by a certain point. Recently, this has been in the news, not specifically with your company, but just last week in the election, voters in Oregon voted down a GMO labeling law. What are your thoughts on how those labeling laws have been perceived in the public, and why did you make that choice for your company?
Well, so the issue of labeling is something that Ben & Jerry's feel strongly about. It's a matter of transparency and having consumers have the right to know what's in the food they buy. There have been a few ballot initiatives in the last few years that have been narrowly defeated, and the one in Oregon, which, as you mentioned, just took place earlier, I think they're actually still counting the votes. The votes aren't official, but it looks like that is going to be defeated by less than a percentage point. And the way it's been is there's a lot of support among the public for mandatory labeling, but the opponents, who tend to be giant food companies and big agriculture companies like, oh, big contributors were Monsanto, DuPont, Coke, and Pepsi, they try to tell voters that it's going to be a lot more expensive if food manufacturers are forced to label their products, which really isn't true. Anybody that's involved in making a food product knows that you change your label all the time, whether it's for new ingredients or different marketing claims. So there's really no added cost to just putting a few words on a package if you use genetic engineering. But that seems to be something that the public is very scared about, and so spending of millions of dollars convinces voters that they don't want to have labeling. There's been labeling laws passed in Vermont last year, and then also in Connecticut and Maine. So it seems like there may be some labeling that comes into play in the next few years.
Certainly an issue we will continue to follow. Before we go, the food world is always so much driven by trends. And where do you see the ice cream world headed, whether it's your company or the overall world of ice cream, from small mom-and-pop boutique shops to the big players in the business?
Well, there is a real growth in smaller boutique ice creams, and particularly local ice creams. There's a movement overall towards more local foods and more sustainable foods, and I think a lot of the growth in the ice cream industry is not from the giant companies, but it's from the smaller manufacturers who are making maybe gelato products or organic products. So that seems to be where things are going. There's also always movement to, I guess, what would be seen as healthier alternatives, whether it's lower fat frozen desserts or non-dairy frozen desserts, something that's based on soy milk or almond milk or coconut milk. I think those are great alternatives. The funny thing for Ben & Jerry's is the company makes low-fat frozen yogurt, it makes Greek frozen yogurt, it makes sorbet, and what always sells best at Ben & Jerry's is the most indulgent flavors with the most flavorings and the most big chunks of cookies and candies. So ice cream is one of those things that people want to be healthy, but they also want it to taste really good.
People love their ice cream, and people love their Ben and Jerry's. Jerry Greenfield, co-founder of Ben and Jerry's, joining us on the phone today. He's giving a talk called Ice Cream, Social Responsibility, and an Innovative Business Philosophy, Wednesday at the William Saroyan Theater in Fresno, part of the San Joaquin Valley Town Hall Lecture Series. Jerry Greenfield, thank you so much for joining us today.
What a treat, and I hope to see folks at the talk.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Joe Moore. Every few months on our program, we try to do a musical segment and not only talk to musicians about their upcoming shows and things, but actually bring some musicians in our studio. And we're very pleased today to have two very talented musicians from different parts of the San Joaquin Valley joining us today. We have Patrick Contreras on violin. Patrick, welcome back to Valley Edition.
Thanks for having me. Good to be back.
And the headliner of today's performance and the headliner, it's new CD that's coming out this Friday night. It's called Too Many Notes. It's by the Jay Smith Group, and Jay Smith joins us here on Valley Edition. Jay, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Jay is a mainstay of the Bakersfield jazz scene, and this new album is going to be released at a CD release party coming up at Sandrini's on Friday night. That's this Friday, 9 o'clock. And it's celebrating this new recording. How long of a project does it take? How long have you put into putting this CD together?
Too long. It's called Too Many Notes. I've been kind of working on this since the last record. You know, we put out a record, 2011. That was called Unashamed Portrayal. So this is the follow-up to that. We got a lot of people online asking us to do another CD, and so I posted a question on our Facebook page saying, you know, if we put out another record, what would you like to call it? So we had a lot of people vote, and the overwhelming conclusion was that it was going to be called Too Many Notes. And that tends to be what people say when they hear me play or they see me play, is that I play too many notes. So a lot of people would take that as kind of a they would kind of shy away from that. But, you know, I am who I am, and that's what I do. I play a lot of notes.
Jay, of course, is a very talented keyboard artist. We have our piano here in the studio, but you play all sorts of different keyboards and patches on this album, some organ things, some piano and other things. Tell me about your influences and your background. Where does the sound of Jay Smith come from?
Well, you know, it's funny. I mean, I actually studied here in Fresno, you know, with Mike Dana and Andre Bush and, you know, a lot of other people at Fresno City College. So for me, that's where, you know, a lot of my, you know, ideas have come from, you know, from guitar players, you know, the weird thing. But, you know, I've also classically trained, in, you know, as a pianist as well. So I tend to listen to, you know, older stuff, but then also try to stay as current as I can. So, you know, I try to, you know, listen to a lot of Art Tatum, a lot of Bud Powell, Thelonious Monk. And you know, as far as what I do, I tend to play, you know, piano. I love playing acoustic piano. It's just, you know, the logistics of playing acoustic piano, you know, in a band setting is it's really hard these days. I can't just drag a acoustic piano around. So I tend to actually have three keyboards, sometimes four, depending upon what it calls for, you know, and try to do a little bit of, you know, everything with that. So I do, you know, Fender Rhodes and, you know, organ and synths and, you know, and I actually just, my girlfriend just bought me a melodica. So I'm going to try to start incorporating that, you know, trying to kind of get away from, you know, playing a piano and try to, you know, be like Patrick and other people and walk out in the crowd.
I was just going to say you could be out in front of the band, not off to the side.
They normally just stick me in the back.
and they can see you over the bank of three keyboards.
Right, exactly. Normally, well, I make sure to make that happen. You know, normally I tend to jump around a lot and, you know, I'm pretty wild on stage, as Patrick will probably tell you.
Our guest is Jay Smith today on Valley Public Radio. His new CD is called Too Many Notes. Let's listen to the opening number, Groove, a little selection from this right now.
And, you know, a quick thing about that, All About Jazz actually just debuted that on their website as the featured download of the day on Thursday. So we're pretty proud of that. It features James Russell on sax. He's actually playing two saxes on this.
Russ on Roland Kirk style.
Yes, exactly. And he was the first time he'd ever done that.
Two saxes at the same time.
At the same
time. No overdubs
in
on
the
that
studio,
one.
You know, and I mean, he was, we were recording everything, and I said, well, why don't you try this? You know, why don't you try two saxes? He's like, I've never really done that before. And I'm like, what are you going to do it now?
Jay Smith here on Valley Public Radio. Did you and Jay connect? Because you're now based in Fresno. Jay, you're based in Bakersfield. Two different music scenes, two very vibrant music scenes. How did you two connect?
Jay Smith and I first met at Fresno City College performing in the practice studios, and we're both in that learning classical music pretty intensely, and I think we're both the two that improvised in the department at the time. So you'd hear each other, because everybody listens to each other across the halls whether they want to admit it or not. So you listen to each other, this is your competition, you know, how much do I need to practice? So I used to hear this guy improvise on kind of Chopin-ish themes, and that's where I was at too. I was improvising, but I was still in my classical mode. So we'd get together and jam because we were the guys, and then I think we both sort of – he started getting into jazz. I'm not sure how, but I know that I started meeting Steve Ono at that time as well. So it was kind of like Jay Smith, Steve Ono – this circle of getting into swing was our first thing, and playing really into Stefan Grappelli and the whole like
absolutely
hot swing. We were like idolizing those guys. So that was our first influence.
Well, speaking of influences and speaking of your ongoing musical relationship, let's go ahead and hear something now here in the Bonner Performing Arts Studio. We have Patrick Contreras and Jay Smith. This is a little different than what you'll hear on the CD, a little bit different styles, but it's a kind of an acoustic unplugged setting here at the station today. So,
well, we're going to do Softly, which is on the record, you know, itself. But and one thing I should mention is we actually did on the record. It was the same, you know, instrumentation. You know, there's a bass on there, but it's actually me playing left hand bass. And so it was just Patrick and I. I think it was pretty much just a one take, you know, situation, pretty much like we're going to have right now.
So this one will be similar to the record.
Very similar.
We're hoping it's going to be similar. You know.
Yeah. We don't know.
Exactly.
Every performance is like a snowflake. Everyone is different.
Exactly. That's very well put, Joe.
Next time somebody asks me to play a cover song, I'm going to tell them that.
Yeah.
All right. Here's Softly as in the Morning Sunrise. The Jay Smith Group, Patrick Contreras and Jay Smith. The new CD is called Too Many Notes, and you're listening to Valley Public Radio. Thank you.
A live performance by the J. Smith Group. We'll release a portion of it. Patrick Contreras, violin, and the leader himself, J. Smith, at the piano here in our Bonner Performing Arts Studio. They are holding a CD release party coming up this Friday night at Sandrini's in Bakersfield. It starts at 9 o'clock. The new CD is called Too Many Notes. Jay, one of the top jazz musicians in Bakersfield. Patrick, one of the top musicians in the Fresno community as well. Jazz and beyond, a rock violin. Before we go, we're going to close with one last number. But before we go, information, you're releasing this CD Friday night. What's going on and how can people find out the particulars?
It's going to be on iTunes, Amazon, Spotify, and 30 other retailers. So, you know, pretty much all the, you know, the mainstays. It's also going to be released on my website, you know, that same day. But if you want a physical copy, you can go to our CD release show, which will be in Bakersfield at Sandrini's. I think it's 1918 I Street. And that starts at 10. We're going to have pretty much everybody on the, you know, that's on the record, you know, is going to be there as well. So I'm really looking forward to it. It's going to be a lot of fun.
And your website?
jsmithgroup.com.
All right. Jay, what do you have to close things out with today?
Well, you know, one of the things that Patrick and I do fairly regularly, we like to challenge ourselves.
Patrick's nodding his head here.
And so we're going to play a blues. We have no idea where it's going to go. We're going to improvise, you know, this last one.
He's going to feel it.
We're going to feel it.
Every snowflake is unique. Jay Smith and Patrick Contreras here on Valley Edition on Valley Public Radio. Thank you.
Well, that's it for today's Valley Edition. We'd like to thank Jay Smith and Patrick Contreras for their in-studio performance. And as always, you can send us your thoughts and comments. Email us, talk@kvpr.org, or tweet us @KVPR and @Valley Edition. For Valley Edition reporter and producer Ezra David Romero, reporter Deanna Aguilera, audio engineer Marv Allen, and production and operations manager Don Weaver, I'm Joe Moore. We'll see you again next week at the same time for another Valley Edition here on Valley Public Radio.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, the California Endowment. Health happens when California values schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And the California Healthcare Foundation, rating hospitals, doctors, and long-term care. Smarter choices start at calqualitycare.org.